From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack, and I'm alone. I'm alone because Evan Dawson is on the sunny beaches of Spain this week with the WXXI Travel Club, so that means I get to play Heart during the podcast. Anyway, it was a busy week on the show with conversations about Rock the Riverway, how to solve America's hunger problem, and if we should fear death. You can hear those full broadcasts on our website, wxxinews.org/connections. But we'll start this week's podcast by remembering Congresswoman Louise Slaughter. Thousands of people attended her funeral service at the Eastman Theater on Friday, including former President Bill Clinton, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi, and many members of our community. Congressman John Lewis was one of Slaughter's colleagues and friends who gave an emotional eulogy. Here are a few of his comments.
Louise, I think most members know, she was strong, she was solid, and she didn't take any stuff. Maybe it has something to do with her growing up in Kentucky. You didn't want to get in an argument with her because you knew in the end she would have the victory or the last say. She would win. I first met Louise during freshman orientation. We were elected together. We soon discovered that we share a love for the arts, and Louise particularly loved music. She loved the creative beauty of our world, of our little planet, our little spaceship we call Earth. You know, sometime in life you run into people who love the world, just love the world, and they don't like people. But Louise loved people. I will never forget when she invited me to come to Rochester in 2016. She was so gracious. She took me to a church that Frederick Douglass attended. She took me all around to several places. She wanted me to see her district. She wanted me to get to know her people. She took me to the mother house where a group of nuns from the Sisters of St. Joseph had retired. It was there I met two nuns who had taken care of us when we were hurt in Selma, Alabama in 1965. They cried, they hugged me, I cried, and Louise cried. Looking back, that moment demonstrated to me the true nature of Louise, this beautiful, unbelievable, gifted, loving sister. She was the person who cared for the caretakers, for those who gave their life in service to the church, or to the community, or to the country. Louise was their champion, the person who fought for them after they had given all they could give. Louise believed deep down in her heart that government should do good for people. I think that is why she continued to serve. She never gave up. She never gave in. She kept her faith. For her, work was a calling, a mission. I'm grateful to her beautiful family, her daughters, her grandchildren, and great-grandson. The people of Rochester and the state of New York for sharing this brilliant, just unbelievable spirit with us for so many years. She was our leader. She was our friend. She was my sister. And that's why I call her Sister Louise. Now, Louise, I know you are watching us with Bob by your side. I cherish every moment that we shared. I must tell you, I love you, and I will miss you. My sister, my friend, we will see you in the morning.
Next, the community is also remembering 14-year-old Trevion Rowe. Rowe was a student at school number 12 who walked off campus on March 8th. His body was found in the Genesee River 4 days later after thousands of people searched for him. His family said he had autism and suicidal thoughts. Rowe's death shocked the Rochester community, and it has sparked calls for change in local school policy. In this clip, you'll hear an emotional call from a listener named Barbara. But first, here's Melanie Funches, Director of Community Engagement for the Mental Health Association of Rochester. She's also a commissioner for the Rochester City School Board. Funches says Rowe's case would have been handled differently if he were white.
Let me be incredibly clear. If Trevion was, if all things were being equal and he was white, the chances of him being able to walk off of the school 12 campus unseen would have been less. The chances of him being able to walk along the expressway to the Freddie Sue Bridge without somebody stopping would have been less. The chances of him being able to go to the bridge, look at the bridge, be on the other side of the bridge and no one stopping for care and concern would have been less. And we, whether we want to talk about it or not, whether we want to own that or not as a community, is up to us. But that does not make it any less a fact, because we know that the literature states there is a study that talks about how young Black boys are seen as larger, older, and more dangerous. There are studies that talk about how young Black boys, there's tons of studies about the way that we as a society view young Black males. When we're not viewing them as a threat, we can view them as they can be rendered invisible. So my thing is that what I'm saying is backed up by the literature. And what I'm saying is that what I want us to not get lost in here is when people first wanted to look for him, it wasn't until we found out that he was a child with autism. It was the intersection of autism that made him visible and had hundreds of people looking. And I'm thankful for the people who looked. I'm a mother of a child on the spectrum. I am thankful that people went out and looked for this baby and brought him home. At the same time, I want us to be able to be in this place, to have the critical conversation that if we're saying we're going to know every child by face and name, and that we are one Rochester, that we do the work that is necessary for us to walk our talk.
Up next on the phones is Barbara in Brighton. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi there. Let me just start out by saying Melanie is totally correct. It's a huge issue across the land. It's not just Rochester, or even that we are not seeing all of our children as all of our children. And that has to do with many, many things: housing segregation, school segregation, history of slavery. We could go on for months. The point is, every one of us is responsible for this child's death, even though we didn't intend that. And more involved with the schools. Schools need to have more resources in the mental health realm, namely more counselors and more social workers. Parents need to be encouraged and made to feel much more comfortable so that when Trevion is feeling bad about his phone missing and he has a history of a suicidal ideation, they can feel comfortable leaving a message or calling until they get an answer saying, meet my kid at the door today. He's feeling particularly bad. Counselors and social workers need to have that connection with the kids, because otherwise, as is demonstrated, people are going to either lie and put down that he's been there today, or they're going to not see the children and not know who's who and not know whether they're there or not and what the individual concerns are. And the special ed teacher I noted is the one who noticed he wasn't there. Now, that's partly because they have smaller classes, but it's also because they're trained to know the kids as individuals, and everyone needs to take more responsibility for that. And that horrifying comment on Melanie's part about seeing a white child crossing the bridge, it's going to make me so upset because it's so true. I really believe that people would have called had it not been a black boy. And we all need to pay more attention to those issues. Otherwise, nothing will change.
Next, how much do you know about guns? Do you feel like you've been gunsplained before? If you haven't heard the term, the concept was recently coined by Adam Weinstein, a veteran and gun owner writing for the Washington Post. He says firearm enthusiasts try to exclude anyone from the gun debate who doesn't know the intricate details of an AR-15 or an M-16. At the same time, he argues that progressives should study up a bit more on guns so as to better understand what they are trying to regulate. Our guests represented both sides of the gun control debate. In this clip, I asked them a question about who they think is eligible to participate in that debate. You'll hear Tim Andrews, the president of the New York State chapter of SCOPE, and Gary Putup, a member of New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Here's the question I asked them. Say you're a mother and you have a 5-year-old in kindergarten and you're hearing about these mass school shootings. You don't know anything about guns. You don't own a gun, but you're worried about your child going to school. In your view, Tim, is that person, is that mother, allowed to participate in this debate about gun control when she doesn't understand the technical pieces of a gun?
I think any American is allowed to participate in the discussion on school safety, is what I'd rather put it, rather talk about than just gun control.
But let's talk about gun control, because that's why we're here.
I understand that, but I think you're taking it out of context. And I think that's exactly my point. There's far more to the issues that are going on in society right now than gun safety. And it isn't really gun safety, it's gun control. Gary makes an assumption that because you're not required by government to take any type of training to get a pistol license, for instance, or to purchase a firearm at Field and Stream, he makes an assumption that people aren't getting trained. And I would contest that's an unfair assumption. There are more people who go through the NRA training programs today than ever have in history. And a good example An example of that is the fact that over the years, gun safety has improved year by year. Fewer and fewer gun accidents occur today than ever occurred in history, even though there are more guns in the country than there ever were. So that would indicate that some kind of training is going on because people aren't out there hurting themselves like they have in the past. But as far as, sure, we should, to try and narrow the debate to, when we're talking about school safety and the safety of our children, to try to narrow the debate to just guns is not really looking in the issue in the fullest of terms as it should.
Well, Tim, I got to say, Tim, I am not making that assumption. And I think it's kind of unfair to assume that I'm making an assumption. I am saying what is fact. There is no training required.
And I agree with that.
And you can argue that maybe more people are taking gun safety courses. One, there's no requirement. Two, that is not indicative of the number of people that own guns. And there's probably no way to tell. And as we know, as for a fact, we have fewer people owning more guns. Just because more people are taking courses doesn't mean that we're at where we should be at. And quite frankly, when you say you're narrowing, that we're narrowing the debate, you'll have to forgive me, but I believe that it's your side that narrows the debate and wants to just keep this to mental health and school shootings. The mother that Megan talked about, it's not just that her child might be shot at school. I mean, we have a real problem in many communities where people are being shot, and gun control and gun safety is an issue, and it has nothing to do with schools. The problem with that argument is you're the one that's, you know, it's the NRA and SCOPE that's trying to narrow it, because it distracts again from the conversation, and it goes right back to this gunsplaining. If we get tied up in the mechanics, if we get tied up in that, all right, then we don't have to deal with the real issue. You know, in regards to like an earlier comment about the FBI and the failures in Florida, let's keep this in mind. And I can tell you this after 30 years in law enforcement, the FBI, the police in Broward County, and that could do nothing, just as we can do nothing in New York. You can go on Facebook. You can say you want to be a school shooter. You can, and I think if you go to YouTube, all you have to do is put in boys shooting assault rifles, and you'll see thousands of these videos. I, as a police officer, can go to that person's house, talk to their parents, talk to them, and there's nothing I can do other than maybe voluntary surrender or voluntary treatment. So again, it's a distraction. When we talk about gunsplaining, this is part of the, excuse me, disingenuousness of the NRA in scope, because they'll sit there and say that nothing was done. But the fact of the matter is, the reason nothing was done is because organizations like the NRA in scope have consistently fought laws preventing that. If that is not the case, then I would challenge scope to come out and support the Emergency Restraining Protection Order, which is going through our state legislature right now, which would allow the FBI, which would allow local and law enforcement to do the things that you're talking about in Florida. But no, the FBI, the NRA, and SCOPE are fighting that. Tim, if that's what you think, then you should be supporting that legislation.
I can't believe that you're sitting there, knowing everything that happened in Parkland, and saying that's a non-issue. There wasn't one thing that went wrong. There wasn't two things that went wrong. There was a multiple list of things that went wrong, whether it was with the school district, whether it was the local sheriff's department, whether it was the FBI. There were plenty of instances that if they'd have been picked up and caught, that incident might very well
Tim,
have been
this
prevented.
Is gunsplaining in action.
Excuse me, but I did interrupt you. I would at least expect enough respect is where I could have my time at the mic. All we're saying is this. You can call it gunsplaining. You can call it whatever you want. That's a cute little term. But the fact is, if you're going to deny that the issue of violence today isn't multifaceted, I really truly believe you're making a mistake. It's easy for politicians, it's easy for people like yourself to stand up and say, look it, we've got to ban these firearms. We've got to get these out of people's hands and ignore everything else that's going on in society.
We'll close this week's podcast with another heavy subject. It was a heavy week. This one is about the Holocaust. When we discuss the Holocaust and Nazi Germany's tactics to create a so-called master race, we frequently talk about the atrocities committed in concentration camps. Holocaust survivors have come forward over the years to share their stories with the hope that by understanding history, we can prevent it from repeating itself. But until recently, there were a number of stories that remained untold or at least hidden. Those belong to the women who lived under Nazi rule, women whose reproductive rights were stripped away and who became part of the Nazi Party's systematic efforts to create an Aryan race. Scholar Beverly Chalmers spent a decade researching sterilization, sex abuse, rape, and extermination in Nazi Germany for her book, Birth, Sex, and Abuse, Women's Voices Under Nazi Rule. She says as difficult as those stories are to hear, we don't have the right to tune them out. In this clip, she shares a story about her young daughter and how her daughter realized it was important to understand the stories of victims and survivors.
I have three wonderful daughters, but the one has been particularly interested in the Holocaust. And as a child, she started reading these books. She found them around the house and picked them up. And she read one, which was the story written by a woman who was a child at the time. And she was a young girl who actually saw her parents being killed in front of her eyes. And she survived the Holocaust. Obviously, her family did not, but she did. And my daughter picked up the story. And when she got to that section where this little girl talked about her mum and dad being killed in front of her, she put the book down and she thought, I can't read this. It could have been me. That could have been me, and that could have been my mum and dad. And I don't want to read it anymore. She put it down, and I saw it, and I just left it. And a few days later, she picked the book up again. And years later, I said to her, what happened, Donna? What made you change your mind? Why did you pick up the book? And she said, well, I realized that that little girl had no choice. She had seen this happen, and she just had to exist. She had to continue, and she managed to survive, and then had the courage to go back as an adult and write the story and tell what had happened to her. She said, if that little girl had the courage to do that, then I owe it to her to read her story, and I have to have the courage to do that too. And I feel very much that we all face that situation. When you start to read the book, it's difficult reading. I must acknowledge that. It can be very shocking to figure and to realize what had actually happened to women. But I believe we owe it to the women to understand them and to know what happened to them. And it's a way of honoring them rather than trying to sweeten the Holocaust, as we often do, or trying to ignore these issues and theorize about them. Actually knowing what happened to them makes us more knowledgeable and more alert to these signs of when things are going wrong in a society.
What are you hearing from survivors? We talked at the top of the show about one woman approaching you at an award ceremony for your book and saying, thank you for telling me your story. Do you find that's common among survivors, or are some hesitant to still talk about their stories, or are they upset that their stories are out there?
In general, women respond very supportively. And like this particular woman, she was herself an Auschwitz survivor. She came to me and pulled her sleeve back and showed her tattoo, and I realized where she had been. And she had tears in her eyes and was just, and she blessed me and said, your work is wonderful, you is blessed, and now I can rest in peace because I know that our story, not only her own, but our story has been told. And that generally is the reaction of people today. I think as the Holocaust survivors are aging and are leaving us, there are very few left now, many of them have turned back to say, I need to tell what happened. And they want their children to now know, and they want posterity to recognize the events and the experiences they went through. And many more of them are turning to writing their memoirs. Of course, these may be tinged by time and society. I've seen that happen too. But most of the time, the more traumatic events are actually remembered almost word for word as they would have been recalled soon after the war. And many more of them are welcoming this and are facing these horrible stories and telling them.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. We're also on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack on double duty because Evan Dawson is
so far away.
Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.